A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching fireworks displays and wondering about the people behind them. What do pyrotechnicians actually do for a living? Do they just bounce from one show to the next? And given that there aren't that many of them, what does a typical day in the life actually look like for someone who specializes in working with fire?
The thing that jumps out at me right away is the numbers. There are only about 4,000 to 5,000 licensed pyrotechnicians in the entire United States, according to ATF data. That's it. That's a workforce smaller than the population of a single small town, supporting a $2.5 billion annual fireworks industry.
You've got this tiny group of people producing these massive citywide spectacles, and the rest of us just show up with blankets and assume it all happens by magic.
Exactly the gap Daniel's pointing at. And the first thing to understand is that pyrotechnician doesn't mean person who lights fireworks. These are licensed explosives handlers. The ATF licensing process takes 6 to 12 months. Background check, fingerprinting, a written exam covering federal explosives law and NFPA codes. You're not just some guy with a lighter.
Which probably explains why the workforce is so small. There's a real barrier to entry, and it's not exactly a job you stumble into at a career fair.
Most people enter through family connections or by joining a union like IATSE Local 728 in certain regions. Apprenticeship programs are rare. And here's the number that really puts it in perspective. The average age of a licensed pyrotechnician is about 55.
So this is a growing workforce handling high explosives. What could go wrong?
It's a genuine concern. But let's start with what most people imagine the job is, the day of the show. Because even that part is wildly more complex than pressing a button.
Walk me through it. I show up at the park at sundown. What's already happened?
The crew's been there since 6 in the morning. First thing is site inspection. They're walking the field, measuring distances to structures and trees, marking the safety perimeter. By 8, they're setting up water barriers if they're near a body of water, because shells launched from barges have different stability requirements. Mortar racks get positioned by noon. These are the tubes the shells fire from, and their placement is precise to within inches because the show is choreographed spatially as well as temporally.
The arrangement of those racks on the ground is essentially a map of what the audience will see in the sky.
Each mortar tube corresponds to a specific position in the aerial canvas. By 4 in the afternoon, they're loading shells into those mortars. This is the most physically demanding and dangerous part of the entire day. A 6-inch shell, which is the most common big shell, weighs several pounds. You're lifting hundreds of them, and each one has to go into the correct mortar tube according to a loading script that maps shell ID to mortar position.
What happens if you put the wrong shell in the wrong tube?
Best case, the choreography is ruined. Worst case, you get a ground-level explosion. A shell that's supposed to burst at 400 feet goes off at ground level because it was loaded into a tube with a different lift charge or bore diameter. That's how people die. It's rare. The injury rate is about one serious incident per 10,000 shows, but the consequence of a mistake is catastrophic.
Which is why the workforce stays small and insular. You don't just hire temps for July 4th.
That's before we even get to the electronics. By 6 in the evening, they're testing the firing system. This isn't a guy with a flare gun. Modern shows use electronic firing systems. Fire 1 and Cobra are the two big names that can handle over 1,000 cues with millisecond precision.
Break that down. What's a cue, and how does the electronics actually work?
A cue is a single firing circuit. Each shell gets its own cue. The firing module sends an electrical pulse down a wire to an E-match. That's a small device with a bridge wire filament coated in a pyrotechnic primer. When current hits the bridge wire, it heats up instantly, ignites the primer, and that ignites the shell's lift charge. The whole chain from button press to ignition is measured in milliseconds.
The laptop running the show is essentially conducting an orchestra of explosions.
The software is handling 1,000 plus instruments. The operator programs the show in advance using software like Finale 3D or PyroSim. They're designing the timing, the sequence, which shells fire when, how they overlap. During the show, they're often just monitoring, but they've got manual backup firing panels ready if the automation fails and redundant batteries on every module. The fail-safes are layered.
What about the shells themselves? You mentioned a 6-inch shell. What's actually inside one of those?
At the bottom, the lift charge, that's black powder that propels the shell out of the mortar. Above that, a time fuse that ignites as the shell launches. The length of that fuse determines the burst altitude, and it's precise to within a few meters. Too short, and the shell bursts too low, too long, and it's already falling. Then, the burst charge at the core of the shell, which explodes outward and ignites the stars.
The stars being the little pellets that create the colors and battens.
And the arrangement of stars inside the shell determines the shape you see in the sky. A ring of stars creates a circle. Stars packed in a specific pattern create a smiley face or a heart or a Saturn shape. Each shell is a precisely engineered device. A single show can have over 500 unique shell types, each with a different burst pattern, color chemistry, and timing profile.
The post show is more than just packing up and going home.
The show ends at 9, the audience leaves, and the crew is just starting the most nerve-wracking part, the post-show sweep. They're walking the field with flashlights, looking for duds. A shell that launched but didn't burst is now a live explosive sitting somewhere in the dark. They have to find every single one before they can clear the site. They're usually not done until 2 in the morning.
An 18-hour day, and that's just the part the public thinks is the whole job.
Here's where Daniel's question really opens up. Because that show day is maybe 30 to 50 days a year for a typical pyrotechnician, what about the other 300-plus days?
This is the part I've never heard anyone talk about. What does a pyrotechnician do in February?
They're in a workshop. Fireworks season is basically May through July plus December 31st. The other 8 months are fabrication, equipment maintenance, and show design. January through April, a lot of these folks are building custom shells by hand. They're mixing star compositions, different metal salts for different colors, strontium for red, barium for green, copper for blue. Blue is notoriously difficult to get right, by the way. The chemistry is finicky.
They're essentially chemists and machinists for most of the year.
They're refurbishing firing modules, replacing corroded connectors, testing continuity on hundreds of E-matches. August through October is post-season inventory, cataloging what was used, what's still in stock, what needs to be ordered for next year. November and December, they're designing New Year's shows in software, programming firing sequences, coordinating with venues and fire marshals for permits.
It sounds like the off-season is where the actual expertise lives. The show day is just the performance.
And here's the economic reality that makes this precarious. Most pyrotechnicians are part-timers or seasonal contractors. A lead tech might make $500 to $1,500 per show, but they're only working 30 to 50 shows a year. Do the math. That's $15,000 to $75,000, and the high end is rare. Full-time year-round positions only exist at the biggest companies, Grucci, Zambelli, Pyro Spectaculars, or at theme parks like Disney and Universal that run nightly shows.
You've got people with this incredibly specialized, dangerous skill set, and most of them are piecing together a living. No wonder the average age is 55. Who can afford to apprentice into this?
That's the talent pipeline problem. The ATF licensing process requires you to work under a licensed tech for 1 to 2 years before you can apply for your own license. But if you're just a loader, an unlicensed helper, you're probably making minimum wage or slightly above working sporadic weekends. It's hard to sustain that unless you have another job or a family connection that's subsidizing your entry.
Yet the demand isn't going away. Fireworks displays are more elaborate every year.
They're evolving in ways that require even more technical skill. Take the Macy's 4th of July show. They integrated 1,000 drones alongside traditional shells. That means the pyrotechnician now has to coordinate with a drone swarm operator, synchronize explosions with lights in the sky, and account for the fact that drones can't fly through burst debris.
That's a whole new layer of complexity. It's not just fireworks anymore. It's a multimodal aerial production.
There's the push towards silent fireworks for urban areas, low-noise shells that reduce the percussive blast. Indoor pyrotechnics for concerts use cold sparks, gerbs, concussion mortars. These require entirely different certifications and safety protocols. The profession is splintering into subspecialties even as the core workforce shrinks.
Let me ask you the question. I think Daniel's really getting at. If someone's watching a fireworks show and they want to appreciate what they're actually seeing, what should they be looking for?
Most people think a fireworks show is just constant explosions, but the 10-second pauses between shells, those aren't dead air. That's choreography. The pyrotechnician is building tension, creating a rhythm. A good show has a narrative arc, an opening salvo, a middle section with varied effects, a build toward the finale. Those pauses are as deliberate as a rest in a musical score.
When you see a gap and think something went wrong, that's actually the craft.
A true misfire looks different. You'll see a shell launch and not burst, or you'll see an asymmetrical pattern where half the stars failed to ignite. But a pause? That's intentional pacing. The other thing to watch for is the spatial composition. A well-designed show uses the full width of the sky. Shells on the left, shells on the right, shells crossing in the middle. That's not random. That's a firing script that maps every mortar position to a specific moment and location in the aerial canvas.
You mentioned the loading script earlier. What does that actually look like?
It's essentially a spreadsheet on steroids. Each row is a cue number, with columns for the mortar rack position, the shell type, the burst altitude, the effect description, the timing offset. The crew rehearses the loading sequence before show day. They walk through the field with the script, verifying that each mortar tube matches what's on paper. One wrong shell in one wrong tube, and you've got a peony where a willow was supposed to be, or worse.
A peony being?
A spherical burst where the stars trail outward uniformly. It's the classic round firework. A willow is the one where the stars trail downward like a weeping willow tree. Different shell construction, different star composition, different visual effect. The audience sees magic. The pyrotechnician sees a three-dimensional matrix of specific chemical reactions, each one ordered from a catalog 6 months ago and loaded by hand 8 hours ago.
That's the ratio that sticks with me. 6 months of design and fabrication, 8 hours of loading, 3 seconds of burst, and then it's gone.
That ratio is the entire story of this profession. The spectacle is ephemeral, 15 to 25 minutes, and it's over. But the work behind each shell is measured in weeks or months. The custom shells for a major show might be fabricated the previous winter. The firing sequence was programmed in March. The permits were filed in April.
What about the safety protocols? You mentioned the injury rate is low, but what's actually keeping it that way?
There's no improvisation on a pyro site. Every procedure is scripted and rehearsed. The NFPA 123 and 1126 codes govern everything from mortar rack construction to minimum distances from the audience. The safety perimeter is calculated based on the largest shell in the show, typically 100 feet of radius per inch of shell diameter. So a 6-inch shell requires a 600-foot safety zone.
Someone's enforcing that.
The lead pyrotechnician is legally responsible. If something goes wrong, the ATF investigates, and the lead's license is on the line. That's another reason the workforce is small and careful. You don't get many second chances in this field. One serious incident can end a career, and the industry is small enough that everyone knows when it happens.
You mentioned the ergonomics earlier. $1,500 for a show sounds decent, until you realize it's maybe 40 shows a year, and you're supplying your own equipment.
Your own insurance. And your own transportation. A lot of these folks are driving hundreds of miles between shows during the season, hauling trailers full of mortars and firing modules. They're sleeping in motels, eating gas station food, and showing up at dawn to start the setup. It's a grind. The romance wears off fast.
Who stays in it? What keeps someone doing this into their 50s and 60s?
Honestly, it's the craft. The people who stick around are the ones who geek out on star compositions and firing sequences. They're the ones who spend their off-season building a custom shell that produces a new shade of purple, or programming a sequence that syncs a crescendo of bursts to a specific measure of music. It's a weird blend of chemistry, electrical engineering, and theater.
It's art made out of explosives.
That's the best definition I've heard. And the audience doesn't know any of this. They see the finale, and they clap, and they have no idea that someone spent November mixing strontium nitrate in a garage workshop to get that exact shade of red.
If someone listening to this thinks, I want to do that, what's the actual path?
Step 1. Find a local fireworks company and sign on as a loader. You don't need a license to be a helper. You're carrying shells, setting up mortars, doing the grunt work under supervision. Step 2. Study for the ATF exam. The test covers Federal Explosives Law, NFPA 123 and 1126 codes, storage and transport regulations. Step 3. Apprentice under a licensed tech for 1 to 2 years. You need documented experience handling explosives. Step 4. Apply for your own pyrotechnician license, which includes the background check and fingerprinting.
Step 5. Keep your day job, because you're not quitting it anytime soon.
This is a side hustle for the vast majority. The people who do it full-time are either at the major display companies or they're running their own small fireworks business, which means they're also doing the sales, the permitting, the client relationships, and the accounting.
It's a small business owner's life with explosives.
With the added twist that your product literally vanishes into smoke. You can't put it on a shelf. You can't send a sample. Your entire value proposition is a 15-minute experience that exists only in memory and cell phone videos.
That's a brutal sales pitch when you think about it. Pay me tens of thousands of dollars for something that will be gone in 20 minutes.
Yet the industry keeps growing. Municipalities budget for it. Theme parks run nightly shows. Weddings and corporate events want pyrotechnics. The demand is there, but the supply of skilled technicians is shrinking.
Which brings us to the drone question. Are drones going to replace fireworks entirely?
I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Drones are precise, they're reusable, they're quiet, and they can form complex shapes in the sky that fireworks can't match. But they lack the visceral element. A fireworks show is not just a visual experience. It's a physical one. You feel the concussion in your chest. You smell the gunpowder. There's a primal quality to fire and explosion that a silent swarm of LEDs can't replicate.
It's not a replacement. It's a new medium alongside the old one.
The pyrotechnicians who adapt, who learn to integrate drones with shells, who understand both firing systems and drone swarm programming, they're going to be the ones who thrive. The ones who refuse to touch anything digital, who insist that real fireworks are only about gunpowder and paper shells, they're going to have a harder time.
That's the story of every skilled trade right now. Adapt or watch the world move past you.
This trade has a particular urgency because of the age profile. If the average pyrotechnician is 55, we're looking at a wave of retirements in the next 10 to 15 years. Who replaces them? The apprenticeship pipeline is thin. The licensing process is slow. And the public doesn't even know this is a career path.
That's the broader point worth making. The fireworks industry is a microcosm of the skilled trade crisis. High barrier to entry, aging workforce, public that takes the output for granted without understanding the input. Same story you see in welding, in machining, in electrical work.
Except welders don't have to worry about a misfire leveling a city block.
The stakes are slightly higher.
That's why the protocols are so rigid. Every pyrotechnician I've ever talked to or read about describes the same thing. The moment before the first shell fires, there's a stillness. Everything's been checked 3 times. The firing system is armed. The safety perimeter is clear, and in that moment, you're acutely aware that you're about to unleash a controlled sequence of explosions over a crowd of thousands of people. If you've done your job right, they'll never think about you at all.
That's the paradox of the profession. The better you are at your job, the more invisible you become. The audience sees the fireworks, not the pyrotechnician.
The pyrotechnician is standing at the firing console, watching the same show as the audience, but seeing something completely different. They're seeing cue numbers and burst altitudes and timing offsets. They're listening for the sound of a shell that didn't ignite. They're scanning for asymmetries that indicate a partial failure. They can't just enjoy the show, they're responsible for it.
The next time I'm watching fireworks, I should be looking at the gaps, the spatial composition, the color transitions. And I should remember that someone spent 6 months designing that star pattern.
8 hours loading it, and 3 seconds firing it. That ratio is the whole story of this craft.
What about the international side? Is this an American phenomenon, or is the profession similar elsewhere?
Similar dynamics, different scale. Japan has a much older pyrotechnic tradition. Their shell making goes back centuries, and the craftsmanship is considered an art form. China is the world's largest manufacturer and exporter of fireworks, but the display technicians there operate under different licensing regimes. Europe has its own certification systems. But the core tension is the same everywhere. It's a niche, aging, underappreciated profession that produces something everyone loves and almost nobody understands.
The people who do it are chemists, electricians, theater producers, and truck drivers all rolled into one.
With a healthy dose of obsessive attention to detail. You don't survive in this field if you're the kind of person who says, good enough. Good enough gets people killed.
There's a life lesson in there somewhere.
But I'm too busy thinking about the fact that somewhere right now, in a garage in Ohio, a 58-year-old guy is mixing copper chloride into a star composition, trying to get a perfect blue burst for a show that won't happen until next July.
Nobody watching that show will know his name.
They never do. That's the deal. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, an Icelandic scribe named John Thordarson copied a now-lost medieval manuscript known as Skarsbok, a richly illuminated collection of apostles' lives. The name Skarsbok comes from the Skarth farm in western Iceland, where the original manuscript was housed before it vanished, probably in a fire, leaving Thordarson's copy as the only surviving witness to the text.
The name literally means the book from Skarth, and without the copy, we wouldn't even know it existed.
A book named after the place it burned up. That's grim. The open question I keep coming back to is this. As drone shows get cheaper and more reliable, does the pyrotechnician become a relic, or does the visceral thrill of real fire and concussive force keep the craft alive? I suspect the answer is both. The profession will shrink further, but the people who remain will be the ones doing the most ambitious, integrated work, the ones who can choreograph fire and light together. The rest will be replaced by a laptop and a swarm of quadcopters. That's probably the right note to end on. The next time you hear a shell burst overhead, remember, someone spent 6 months designing that star pattern, 8 hours loading it, and 3 seconds firing it. That's the whole story.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone about it. The show grows by word of mouth, and we appreciate every listener who spreads the word. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.